5 minutes worth of talks. So at any rate, I'll start out with some information that we did prior to reviewing final reports. We'll have a brief overview of the status of the Cooperative Research Partners Program funding, and then the management review of the 12 final reports. Briefly, Carolyn Woodhead briefed us on a final report produced by the National Marine Fisheries Service following an East Coast strategic planning exercise. The report identifies cooperative research priorities and directions for 2010 to 2014. And for those of you who are listening to the tape, you can find that at the NOAA NERO website if you want to look it up in the email. We were also briefed on funding solicitations that were put out over the summer. These are on a very quick turnaround. This is information that has been identified as high priority, hopefully to let these contracts in this fall. Those things are an industry-based fishery independent fixed gear survey to fill in existing data gaps. Second, an enhanced stock monitoring supporting the management transition to allowable catch limits and sectors. And third, expanding conservation engineering studies with an emphasis on bycatch reduction and industry assistance in adopting this new technology. So does anybody have any questions on that? Okay, then I'll move into the final reviews. As I said, we reviewed 12 final reports. I can't really do all these reports justice in the time allotted, so I hope that people will take a look at them. There's a lot of good, useful information here that I can't convey in a short time period. So basically what I'm going to do is give a very quick project summary, and then the Research Steering Committee's questions and comments, and if anybody has any questions on the council, we'll try to answer them at that time. Just so I won't have to keep saying it, we basically recommended that all 12 of these reports be moved to the appropriate plan development teams for incorporation into the management process. The first report was an employment, income, working conditions, and vessel safety in New Bedford, Dr. Dan Georgiana. This report discusses the socioeconomic impacts associated with implementing the major revision to the rules governing the harvest of New England groundfish, basically Amendment 13. As described by the authors, the study offers evidence that supports the economic decline for New Bedford's dragger fleet described in the environmental impact statement section of Amendment 13. The EIS predicted a 40% reduction in days at sea per year between 2002, the first year of the interim rule preceding Amendment 13, and 2005, the year after Amendment 13 was implemented. The number of offshore draggers that identified New Bedford or Fairhaven as their home port declined, reducing the employment of fishermen in the offshore dragger fleet. Average net crew share and average income of fishermen also declined for vessels in New Bedford's offshore dragger fleet, but crew members' average watch time on deck increased. That's basically the summary of the report. The Research Steering Committee agreed with the reviewers that the work was informative and useful, and also agreed that, although intuitive, the conclusions that Amendment 13 to the Northeast Multi-Species Plan caused changes in employment and it requires empirical modeling. The principal investigator explained there was some work on this issue after the project was complete, but that it was not included in the report. The committee agreed that more work on the social economic dynamics of fisheries should be encouraged, in particular follow-up efforts to evaluate changes after implementation of a management action. The principal investigator, we also had quite a discussion about the information that they would need to gather to be able to do this kind of analysis, and they had suggested some changes to the vessel trip reports or perhaps other ways to capture information on crew, number of accidents at sea, and other relevant information that could be made available to social scientists. And since those aren't changes that could readily or easily be moved through the management process, we agreed as a committee to forward those during appropriate management actions as they came up rather than make a motion to actually try and change things at this time. So does anybody have any questions or comments on that report? Okay. Second report was institutionalizing social science data collection. This was with Dr. Madeline Hall-Arba, David Bergeron, and Dr. Bonnie McKay. Okay, project summary, the community panels project, as it was called, explored the potential for community-based data collection and analysis to address the scarcity of social science data in New England fishing reports. Relying on suggestions from an advisory group, panels of 10 to 12 individuals representing a cross-section of the fishing industry and associated communities were established in three ports, Jonesport, Beals Island, Maine, Gloucester, Massachusetts, and Scituate, Massachusetts. Panels each identified issues of concern to their port, sought data through meetings and interviews, and drafted a report of their results. In order to have a basis for comparison among the three ports, each considered infrastructure needs as one of the topics of concern. The authors felt that the panels proved to be a useful starting point for eliciting community responses to change and providing information useful to management. And then the research steering committee commented that the committee members took note that the final report reflected on the Northeast Consortium-funded component of the project only. Members agreed with the technical reviews concerning the issues using the panels during a one-time effort in lieu of the development of an effective ongoing data collection program. Committee agreed that a more systematically collected information would be more helpful in management decision-making, although the information collected was informative. Committee appreciated the efforts of the principal investigators with respect to sharing lessons learned, as well as efforts of the panel participants to provide the information. So basically what happened here is you had a kind of a snapshot of these three ports during this period to give you some idea of the changes in the infrastructure, what information would be needed in the future, what infrastructure will be needed. But it did not develop a systematic way of collecting this information in the future. So does anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, Frank?
Just one comment. This issue or a similar issue came up at the social science workshop when we were talking about sector performance measures. She was there, and I think that the information that they developed out of this project is going into that process.
Good. I mean, this was a very useful process, yeah. Especially for identifying infrastructure and how some of these ports, such as Gloucester, for example, are really a hub port for all the outlying smaller ports, and that if the infrastructure in these ports shrinks too much, that they'll lose that function. But it also impacts the outlying ports, the small communities that have to drive to a place like Gloucester to get supplies. So there's a lot of information in here that's quite useful.
I think also the need for an ongoing effort, data collection effort, that comes up over and over again, and we're totally aware of that.
Yeah, as I said, this was a snapshot, and it was identified by the participants that an ongoing effort was really needed. So I'm sure they'll be happy to know the information's being used. Okay. The next report was charting anecdotal information and oral histories on Stellwagen Bank from local commercial fishermen. This was with, again, Dr. Madeline Hall-Arba and David Bergeron. This project was to document the extent and value of fishing activities on Stellwagen Bank over three decades and to see how this may have changed over time. Specific objectives were to involve fishermen in the data collection, charting, and analysis used to develop charts that depict seasonal fishing grounds by gear sectors, target species, economic value, and seafloor characteristics, and to build a working relationship among commercial and recreational fishing and scientific communities. And this produced high-resolution charts that were developed to depict seasonal fishing grounds by gear sectors and target species. Interviews elicited information about the significant economic value of fishing on the bank to multiple fishing sectors and obtained some information about seafloor characteristics. The project found that the combination of charts and interviews were an extremely valuable, non-threatening method to obtain information of interest to both the fishing industry and to managers. According to the authors, the project accomplished this goal of documenting the patterns associated with three decades of fishing on Stellwagen Bank by commercial and recreational fishermen. Clusters and patterns could be discerned, for different gear types and target species. The research steering committee commented that members generally agreed with the technical comments provided, adding that this and other reports like it would prove useful in looking at restricted or special access areas, marine spatial planning efforts, marine protected areas, and things of that like. They felt that all council committees and their PDTs might find the information useful, although the project may not be a complete picture of all the fishing effort occurring on Stellwagen Bank during the period considered. Committee members used this discussion to highlight the question of what additional information should be collected through the National Marine Fisheries Service data gathering programs, such as the study fleet, industry-based surveys, and projects such as that. Any questions on this one?
Yeah, not so much a question, but a comment, and that is the Stellwagen Bank Zoning Working Group meets next week, and I would assume that this document will be made available for that working group discussion. I'm part of that working group, and I've got nothing but praise for Madeline and company, who have done a great job providing that which heretofore has not existed, a documented accounting to the extent that it can be done, the way in which fishing is dispersed, distributed seasonally throughout the Stellwagen Bank area. So I'm very glad that this work has been done, and I suspect it will go a long way towards zoning discussions or marine spatial planning discussions that relate to Stellwagen Bank.
Yes, we did also recommend that this be forwarded to the marine sanctuary people so that they could look at the fishing patterns within the sanctuary. I mean, if you look at the actual charts that they developed, you could see very high concentrations of efforts of different gear types over the entire 30-year period. I mean, some of these areas are very heavily fished over and over again, year after year after year, and they've produced fish year after year after year after year. So it hopefully will be useful information for people trying to understand the dynamics of fishing in this area. Okay. Anybody else? Okay. Staying alive, promoting a culture of safety at sea in New England's fishing industry. This was with David Bergeron, Dr. Madeline Hall Arbor. And this project built on New Bedford's successful safety training programs, extending the benefits of easy access to training and building an ethic of safety at sea to fishermen not only in New Bedford and Gloucester, but several other satellite ports in the Commonwealth. Participation of the Mass Lobstermen's Association, Plymouth Lobstermen's Association, Mass Bay Groundfish, Provincetown Fishermen's Association, Gloucester Fishermen's Wives, and other MFP member organizations as formal outreach partners for this project attracted fishermen who had not been well represented in safety training in the past. 307 fishermen participated in the training sponsored by this project. And the Research Steering Committee commented that members agreed the project was very useful as well as successful, but commented that the PIs may not have achieved all of their proposed objectives, although additional information was provided in an accompanying journal article. They agreed that documentation of the progress achieved by the industry was helpful and supported further investment in projects that address the issue of safety at sea aboard fishing vessels. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, continue on. The next report was an Atlas-based audit of fishing territories, local knowledge, and community participation in fishery science and management. This was with Dr. Kevin St. Martin and Madeline Hall Arbor. And this project, the purpose of the project was to produce a digital atlas and GIS, or Geographic Information System, database for the Gulf of Maine and Georges Bank. The atlas, which is still in development, focuses on the social geography of the region and was produced in cooperation with fishermen and community-based researchers. Areas of primary fishing effort by community were mapped and characterized using the National Marine Fisheries Service vessel data. This is some of it's VMS, and I believe some of it was VTRs as well, but mostly VMS. The maps form the basis for interviews with fishermen who worked in the locations defined by the maps. The interviews had two goals. The first was to verify and correct the maps. The second was to assess the range of environmental information available from fishermen and then under what sort of conditions they would be willing to share their information. Given initial results, the PIs concluded there are distinct and consistent territories used by fishing communities and or gear sectors. In addition, fishing communities utilize and maintain significant local knowledge about such locations. This project documents these findings in a form of detailed maps and interview narratives. The authors maintain the results constitute a valuable resource for both fisheries managers, scientists, and fishing communities. The Research Steering Committee commented that the project was a very useful effort, accompanied by good publications. We did not have the atlases at our meeting, and we communicated this information to the PIs that we needed that information to finish the review. Subsequent to our meeting, the Council has received the final report with the atlases. It describes, quote, a database of all valid vessel trip locations linked to vessel principal port by year, derived from the National Marine Fisheries Service vessel trip report and permit tables. The database originally developed for change analysis and for mapping the most recent patterns of fishing in the Gulf of Maine for this project has been regularly updated and continues to be useful for mapping and change analysis. The tables are in ArcGIS DBF format and currently reside on a secured computer at Rutgers University. Given the confidential nature of 11 individual trips and vessels, the data set cannot be distributed in its current form. A website is under development that will allow users to query the data by an appropriate level of aggregation. From the database of trip locations, 43 unique maps were developed for this project. Given the current availability of all the information necessary to conduct its review, the Research Steering Committee will complete its evaluation of this project at its next meeting. Does anybody have any questions on this one? It's a pretty interesting project. David?
Well, you answered the question I was going to ask. Your committee is going to address this work at your next meeting. Very glad you're going to do that. Once again, I find this to be an outstanding piece of work published, and one part of it was published in Human Ecology Review. I like the journal that they published it in, Human Ecology. It's going to be extremely useful to us as we deal with marine spatial planning, socioeconomic impacts of our regulations. I found some of their comments to be, right on the mark in that they found it very difficult. I shouldn't say very difficult. They talk about community shoreside, but they also talk about what has been created by fishing rules and regulations, that is, new communities that are at sea. So there's an at-sea community, and just as there is a land-based community of fishermen. A lot of great quotes, and I look forward to using this document and some of my own state initiatives, as well, of course, some of the council initiatives. Job well done.
Yes, these communities at sea are probably the chief finding of this, in addition to the charts, is that, for example, in where I'm from, Ipswich Bay, you have boats from three states fishing there. We may hail from ports 40 or 50 miles apart, but we all fish in the same grounds, and we all know the grounds, and we all communicate with each other. And it's similar with other ports. I mean, you can see very clearly clusters of fishing effort, not necessarily related to one port. So hopefully that'll be useful to management in the future. The next report we reviewed was the development of multi-beam sonar as a fisheries tool for stock assessment and EFH essential fish habitat identification of ground fish in the western Gulf of Maine. And this was with Dr. Hunt Howell from UNH. Now, the purpose of this study was to prove the concept of using multi-beam sonar as a fisheries tool for studying the behavior and quantifying the abundance of ground fish. The focus of this research was to develop multi-beam sonar as a fishery survey tool. Multi-beam sonar can complement traditional narrow-beam echo sounder and trawl surveys because it has a large sampling volume, three-dimensional spatial description, and potentially fewer behavior-related sampling biases than traditional trawl surveys. Relationships between acoustic backscatter and fish biology need to be understood before reliable acoustic surveys using multi-beam sonar can provide science-based information for stock assessments. And what this study did is they basically put fish in the UNH fish pen, and then they went out and used the acoustic device over the fish pen to see if they could actually count the number of fish in the pen and to see what kind of acoustic signature it provided. The authors stated that preliminary results demonstrate the feasibility of this machine to detect cod and show that quantification of the acoustic backscatter is possible. The research steering committee agreed that the project was well-designed, with information provided in a well-written report, and echoed the compliments included in the technical reviews. Members agreed the technique explored here would be useful to management once fully developed and encourage further work in this area. Project participant Chris Gershon briefed the committee on additional work that is in progress. So does anybody have any questions on that? Yes, Terry.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. This project intrigues me. Could you elaborate on the additional work in progress?
Well, they went out and did ground truthing with the trawl as well, and then tried to identify the number of fish there, and they're still in the process of analyzing that information. I think that's the major work that's still going on. I'm not mathematically smart enough to exactly understand some of this analysis that goes into this, but they're very complex algorithms that are used to basically convert the signal into number of fish.
Is your gut instinct that this might be a viable tool?
In the near term, no. In the long term, potentially. And again, this is my own personal opinion that they still have a long ways to go, to identify various species. Is it a cod? Is it a haddock? Is it a heron? They can do some of that. They can identify fish by size. It certainly has the ability to get at this issue of what happens when the fish aren't on the bottom. We all know that cod go up and down, haddock go up and down, all these fish do. And a trawl survey can only capture what's within the range of the trawl. So in the long term, I think it has a lot of benefit, but it's not ready for prime time yet.
Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, David. Again, good work. I'm very encouraged by the progress that has been made by the investigators. I agree with you that it does have long-term potential. A year ago, we actually did, in the Division of Marine Fisheries, did some similar work in our waters to try to determine the size, the abundance of cod aggregations inside state waters. And I was amazed at some of the preliminary results and estimates of the biomass of codfish within certain aggregations of codfish. They were rather astounding. And before I ran with the information, of course, I checked with the investigator, and he said, stop, cease. There are certain assumptions that have to be made. So it was a lesson to us that it's got potential. This work needs to be continued because it does offer up perhaps a very important assessment tool for cod in the Gulf of Maine and elsewhere, because after all, cod aggregate, and you need to be able to assess them when they're aggregated as well as dispersed, but certainly when they're aggregated. So I encourage this work to continue and future projects along these lines to be supported.
I think another point to keep in mind here, too, is this is a potentially non-invasive way of surveying fish. There are areas that can't be trawled, areas perhaps that we don't want to trawl in. This is a towed array, or it can be mounted on a vessel. It's basically non-invasive. So that's another thing that will enter into this as we try to look at fish in areas that we have not been able to traditionally survey. No further comments, questions? Okay. The next report we reviewed is an intensive study of the Western Gulf of Maine closed area, Dr. Ray Grizzle from UNH. This was a very large project. It covered a number of years. It was an interdisciplinary investigation of the effects of the Western Gulf of Maine closure. It represented the initial stages of a planned longer-term project to determine various ecosystem-level impacts of the closure. The focus of most of the Northeast Consortium-funded portion of the project was on seafloor conditions in a 400-square-kilometer area, roughly 150 square miles, study area located along the western boundary of the closure, half inside and half outside. Following an initial multi-beam sonar mapping effort that produced a 5-meter pixel resolution bathymetric map of the study area, approximately 170 sites were sampled with some combination of box corer, shipwreck grab, and towed videography to characterize sediments, infauna, and epifauna. And the bottom types ranged basically all types from soft mud to the hardest bottom there is. And they compared the areas inside and outside the closure. Again, this is a report that you really should review. There are a lot of qualifications in the report in terms of, you know, how do you deal with the fact that the area inside the area, the closed area, and an area outside may, even though they're both hard bottom, as an example, may not be exactly the same kind of hard bottom, different kind of rock formation or whatever. So there's a lot of qualifications in this report that require people to carefully read the what they had to say. Infauna density and taxonomic richness were significantly higher inside the closure compared to outside, with the most differences in the sandy sediments. These in versus out differences in univariate measures were also reflected by differences in community taxonomic composition. The authors state that overall these data indicate the removal of gillnets, mainly used in rocky habitats, and autotrols, mainly used in soft bottom habitats, has allowed substantial recovery of seafloor invertebrate communities in some areas within the closure. Members agree that the report was complete, comprehensive, and well done. The exploration of gillnet impacts was particularly illuminating and prompted the committee to agree that such work raises questions for managers about balancing fisheries impacts with habitat protection. Members concurred with the technical reviews generally, which were encouraging with some criticisms provided along with the final report. Probably the most, if you want to call it, controversial aspect of this report is this issue of the finding that apparently hauling gillnets in complex bottom changes the taxonomy of the bottom. This is probably the first time this has been reported. It's going to need follow-up work to confirm it. They did not say flat out that it does cause change. They said it appears to cause change. And this is a new finding. And again, they discussed the possible explanations. Their feeling was that most probably it had to do with hauling the gear on a windy day when the boat gets swept. Or this area is also swept by quite strong currents, and the boat may get set quite a ways during the hauling process, and as it does, it drags the gillnet along with it. The committee basically agreed the same thing, that this information needs to be looked at and perhaps explored further. Any questions or comments? Okay. The next report we did was an assessment of escape vent selectivity, bycatch, and discard survivability in the New England fishery for deep water red crab. This was with Dr. Shelley Talick from GMRI. This project summarized the growth of the red crab fishery. The author states that the sustainable management of the deep water red crab fishery requires accurate stock assessment and modeling techniques capable of predicting the response of the resource to future exploitation, including the impacts of bycatch. In addition, the fishery requires fishing techniques capable of minimizing the impact of fishery operations on undersized red crabs in non-target deep water, in non-target species in the deep water communities. The project had three goals: undertake escape vent trials as a means of minimizing the impact of handling and discard processes, identify and quantify bycatch, both target species and non-target, from data obtained during commercial fishing operations, and investigate the survival rate of deep water red crab, which experience being hauled from depth and returned to the seafloor. Consider physiological discard processes and predation effects. Results reported by the authors are as follows. Escape vent trials were assessed during a 10-day research trip. Five different gear designs were assessed with relative catch compositions between two depths, 600 meters and 800 meters. A large proportion of undersized crab are caught, and 72 to 100%, depending on the trap condition and market size applied, i.e. 4-inch or 4.5-inch. The medium-sized ring, a 10-centimeter internal diameter, is proposed as showing the optimum balance between catch of marketable versus non-marketable red crab. In the fishery, we're currently using a 9-centimeter ring. So this showed them that by going up a little bit in the ring size, they could cut down on the discard of undersized crabs. Bycatch data were collected during the escape vent trials. Bycatch of non-target species totaled 16 individuals out of 450 trap hauls. This low level of non-target species in the catch is consistent with past surveys during commercial red crab trips. Comparison of the current study's data with early fishery-dependent data is confounded by small data sets and temporally discrete sampling periods. Nonetheless, an underlying trend is evident, according to the author. The catch of undersized red crab can be high, as can the catch of non-marketable females. For the deep-water red crab fishery, the primary bycatch concern appears to be that of non-marketable target species. The fishery is, quote-unquote, clean in terms of impacts on non-target species. So that was the second finding of this report. And then there were a variety of experiments were initiated to assess survival rate of deep water red crabs, which are hauled from depth and are then returned to the seafloor. The overall finding was that approximately 5% of red crab assessed in the study died. It was shown that both higher impact handling techniques, i.e. dropped versus slid crabs, and multiple haul frequencies representing multiple capture events in a single trip are likely to increase the discard mortality rate for deep sea red crab. Most of the committee agreed the report was well done, although some details of the study design were considered difficult to discern from the report. Members added that an estimate of discard mortality would have been useful. A follow-up study was recommended as a useful exercise that would provide more context for the information in the current report, since some of the circumstances of the fishery, i.e. size of crabs harvested, have changed. Further studies should focus on the optimal size and shape for rings and a minimum crab size. Committee recommended forwarding the report to the Red Crab PDT, and the Research Steering Committee also included generally positive reviewer comments attached to the report. So any questions on red crabs? Okay. Moving along, if my voice will let me. An industry-science partnership investigating the short-term and long-term discard mortality of spiny dogfish using hook gear in Gulf of Maine waters. This was a joint project, I guess you'd call it a shotgun marriage, if you will, between the Gulf of Maine Research Institute and the Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association. It's kind of two projects rolled into one. And this was a collaborative project that represented a partnership between the two organizations. And they worked in waters of the Gulf of Maine and off of southern New England. The primary research objective was to investigate the short-term discard mortality rate of dogfish from different commercial hook gears. Survivability was investigated through caging studies. And then if you read the report, there's a series of data information here provided on the number of dogfish caught, what their male-female ratios were, whether they were snubbed, unsnubbed, and control. And basically, the significant finding here is an overall regional difference in short-term discard mortality was observed The Gulf of Maine Research Institute recorded significantly lower total mortality, 7%, than the Hook Association, 22%. Regional average findings showed a sex effect, with males demonstrating higher mortality, 26%, than females with 14%. The largest dogfish of each sex demonstrated greater resilience to mortality. So basically, you had a range in mortalities from the warmer waters to the south to the colder waters to the north, and it's not terribly unexpected, especially when you bring a fish up through a thermocline. Treatment effects were observed, with mortality being highest in snub fish than unsnubbed fish. And finally, the control fish, which this is an important piece of information. The controlled fish were caught on individual hook and line, and they still had a 13% mortality. So, there's mortality associated with all kinds of fishing, is the takeaway report from this particular piece of information on dogfish. And you can, look over the rest of the information there. There was considerable variation, and the study's long-term effects on discard mortality assessments were aborted for logistical reasons, and as such, these findings represent a range of likely short-term discard mortality from hook years or across the region. Basically, they wanted to bring in a bunch of dogfish and put them in a holding pen for quite a period of time, and for a number of reasons that we don't have to go into, that just never was able to happen. The Research Steering Committee agreed that the key findings of this report included confirmation that some level of mortality is associated with all gear types, as well as the level of mortality underlined in the above text. The committee also concurred with the technical comments provided by the consortium. So does anybody have any questions on dogfish? David?
All right, so it's this work got the thumbs up from the Research Steering Committee. I assume, therefore, that this particular piece of work will be used during the benchmark assessment for dogfish. Dogfish mortality has played a major role in the assessments in the past, and I assume right now. Mr. Chairman, I guess this is to Rick. I'm hopeful that this particular information will be reviewed, and perhaps it will be instrumental in revising some of the discard mortality rates we now have for dogfish by gear type, revising them downwards. At least that's the way it appears from this research, subject to further look-see, I guess, by the peer review people.
So. I think this is the last piece of the puzzle. I mean, we have information now on gillnets, trawls, and this is hooks, so hopefully we should be able to start using that information now. Any other questions or comments on dogfish? Okay. Next was an evaluation of finfish bycatch rates inside the Great South Channel scallop dredge exemption area for the general category scallop fishery. This was Maggie Raymond with Dr. Graham Sherwood, Laura Taylor-Singer, Catherine Solano, GMRI. This was another big project, very ambitious. The overall goal of this project was to provide managers and fishing communities with information to manage scallop and finfish resources in the Great South Channel dredge exemption area with less uncertainty and greater stakeholder confidence. Objectives included describing current catch and bycatch rates for the general category fleet. Additional objectives included documenting and analyzing the quantity and composition of finfish bycatch in the study area, especially during the seasonal yellowtail spawning closure, which is April through June, to provide information unavailable from other sources. Other objectives included analysis of the quantity, distribution, and maturity stages of yellowtail flounder in an area during the seasonal spawning closures, examination of the species and size selectivity of 10-inch mesh twine top in a 10.5-foot scallop dredge was also attempted. Field work for this project occurred between March and September 2007, 53 fishing days, 244 tows. Uh, And at first, it was basically to map the area to find out where commercial quantities of exploitable scallop biomass was located. And then after that, it concentrated on those areas. Species and size selectivity information was collected on approximately a third of the completed tows by means of a small mesh cover net that captured the fish and other organisms that passed through the large mesh twine top. Results of the study indicate that the addition of the Great South Channel area to the list of current scallop dredge exemption areas was an appropriate action. Sea scallops can be harvested for portions of the exempted area in commercial quantities using the general category scallop dredge gear with a very low fin fish bycatch rate. Commercial quantities of sea scallops were found in waters ranging in depth from 20 to 50 fathoms. The research steering committee basically commented here that there's an awful lot of information in this report in terms of a census of the area and things of that nature. But we had concerns with the use of three different dredge vessels with three different dredge sizes and different twine top sizes and a lack of an extrapolation of impacts to fleet-wide impacts. We also didn't have enough information to do our own analysis. There was no information on the swept area and the towing speeds. There was no gear diagrams. There was no way to really quantify exactly what each dredge had done and then compare the dredges one to the other. These issues, along with a fair amount of speculation by the authors, led committee members to agree with the technical review, particularly its last paragraph, in which I quote, "It is premature to reconsider the yellowtail flounder spawning closures or revisions to the timing of these closures from the information in this study." So, again, while there's a lot of useful information here, we do not have enough information to extrapolate an analysis of what was done with these three vessels to the entire general category scallop fleet if it was to be deployed in this area. So does anybody have any questions on this one? Okay. Getting to the end, folks. Design and test of grid devices to improve size and species selectivity in the Gulf of Maine multi-species trawl fishery. This was with Dr. Pingo-Hee from the University of New Hampshire. And I'm going to summarize this one very quickly. They looked at a number of different grid combinations, basically grates, to try and exclude various types of groundfish from a trawl net. They tested these at the Flume Tank in Newfoundland, and they went out and tested them in the commercial fishery. And the long and the short of it is that no effective gear modification was developed that allowed the escapement of cod, while at the same time limiting the loss of harvestable finfish. So they looked at a number of different combinations. None of them basically worked. The report's well done. Sometimes learning what doesn't work is just as useful as learning what does work. In this case, they didn't find anything that worked. So does anybody have any questions or comments about that one? Okay. Last but not least, design and test of the topless shrimp trawl and size sorting grid system to reduce finfish bycatch and small shrimps in the pink shrimp fishery. This was with Dr. Pingo-Hee, again, from the University of New Hampshire, and with myself as an industry partner. I just jumped down to the Research Steering Committee comments and note that I was a partner on this project and recused myself from the discussion other than to answer questions. Vice Chairman David Preble chaired this portion of the meeting and crafted a consensus that the experiment was successful. Basically, what we did here is we tried a radical design of a net. We removed the square and most of the top belly with a feeling that those are used to catch fish, and that we're not trying to catch fish here, we're trying to catch shrimp, and that the idea was that the shrimp probably, you don't need the top of the net to retain the shrimp, and that's what we found. The gear works very well. I use it in the shrimp fishery on my own. The next step in this process would have been to see if you could take an existing commercial trawl and do the same thing, take the top of the net out. The answer is we don't know that answer because it hasn't been done yet. This was a specifically built net. It is fundamentally different shape than a traditional trawl net. I can tell you we've entered it in the Smart Gear contest. And if anybody has any questions, I'll be happy to answer them after the meeting or now. It's something I'm very personally involved in and think very highly of.
Doug Grip?
Yes.
Just a quick question. Did it have a grade in it?
It has the Nordmeer grade in it. And what we've actually done, the hybrid that I'm using now has a size sorting grid, which in this part of the experiment, in this particular funding source, we were not able to successfully make it work. We have since modified it so that it does work successfully. You basically have a sorting grid ahead of the Nordmoor grate at a 45-degree angle, which the shrimp bounce off of. The small ones go through. They go up over, through a funnel down to the bottom of the Nordmoor grate, and then through the traditional Nordmoor grate setup. So we've been able to remove the small shrimp from the catch, and the net itself, again, my way of thinking as a fisherman is, the Nordmoor grate's kind of like the backup device. That's the when all else fails device. When something bounces off the grate, that's better than not catching it, but the best thing is to never put it through the net in the first place. And what we've done by removing the top of the net, at least with fish that rise, such as herring and haddock, is to let them just swim out of the net before they ever encounter the grate. So there's no risk of, you know, whatever occurs when you bounce off the grate.
Yeah, thanks, David. Do you have an estimation on the efficiency of it compared to a normal shrimp trawl?
I catch about 15% more shrimp than people in similar size gear beside me. So it's actually more effective than a traditional trawl. And the shrimp counts are, when the counts are over 55, there's quite a statistical difference in the counts. Mine will stay right around 55. When the counts are below 55, which is the number of shrimp per pound, there's no difference between that and a trawl not using the sorting grid.
That's pretty cool.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, in that case, that concludes the report of the Research Steering Committee.
Okay. Thank you, David. Move right into Monkfish Committee. Terrier Fildy.